The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with an article from the Elements section of the March 5th, 2024 online edition of the New Yorker magazine, The Magic of Bird Brains. Crows are smart enough to pick up trash. Why won't they? By Ben Crear. At around 9 a.m. every weekday, a crow caws in the Jardin des Plantes, the oldest botanical garden in Paris. The sound is a warning to every other crow. Frédéric Jugay, a tall ornithologist whose dark hair is graying around the ears, has shown up for work. As Jugay walks to his office at the French National Museum of Natural History, which is on the garden's grounds, dozens of the black vandals take to the trees and rain abuse on him, as though he were a condemned man. "I think I'm the best friend of French crows," Jugay told me, "but I am probably the man they hate most." Crows are famous for holding grudges. Their beef with Jugay started in 2015 when the Paris government hired him to study their movements around the city. Farmers blame crows for crop damage, and hunters shoot hundreds of thousands of the birds each year. In Paris, some district managers wanted permission to cull them for tearing into trash bags and digging up lawns. But Jugay questioned the wisdom of killing so many crows. "It cost a lot to destroy pests," he remembers thinking. "Can it really be efficient to destroy all these lives?" Outside his office, Jugay began baiting net traps with kitchen scraps such as raw eggs and bits of chicken. He removed one bird at a time with his bare hands. Then he stuffed the bird into a cloth tube that he had cut from his daughter's leggings to immobilize the bird while he recorded its weight on a scale. Finally, he strapped a colorful ring, which was labeled with a 3-digit number, to the bird's leg. Eventually, Jugay erected a metal cage the size of a woodshed in the garden to trap the birds. Crows could fly in, but they couldn't escape until Jugay let them out. Although some of the birds meekly accepted their fates, some pecked at him furiously when he ringed their legs. Over the years, Jugay has caught and released more than 1,300 crows. He also built a website where people could report sightings. These efforts revealed a big shakeup every spring in which year-old crows flew the coop and looked for new habitats. Some Parisian crows were spotted as far away as the Dutch countryside, but most formed new flocks in the city's green spaces where there was garbage to eat. Jugay convinced the city government that there was no point in trying to kill a park's crows. After all, new ones would arrive within a year. "This project definitely changed the view of Parisian politicians on crows," he said. Recently, he published a book about coexisting with crows. The birds were not very appreciative, however. Many of them remembered when Jugay had caged, manhandled, and banded them. Some had never flown into his trap, but still learned from their peers and joined in the cawing. Crows even recognized him when he showed up for work in a surgical mask after months of working from home during the pandemic. Jugay, a lifelong bird watcher, was learning how it feels when birds watch back. For most of the 20th century, psychologists dismissed the interior lives of birds because avian brains are smaller and differently structured than those of mammals. But it turns out that bird brains are much denser with neurons and consume less energy, giving crows similar cognitive abilities to large-brained mammals such as great apes, elephants, and whales. John Marsluff, an ecologist in Seattle, once wore a rubber caveman mask while catching and releasing 7 crows on its university campus. 18 years later, crows that weren't alive for the original experiment still caw at the mask. I really didn't know they were paying that much attention to me, Marsloff told me recently. His study showed that crows not only retain long-term memories, but also learn from their peers and past behaviors from one generation to the next. Other experiments have shown that members of the corvid family, which includes crows, jays, and magpies, can read one another's intentions, plan for the future, and solve puzzles using abstract reasoning and tools. To Shigay, the ridicule of the crows was a revelation. I'm just realizing how intelligent they are, he told me. When birds warn one another about individual humans, biologists understand them to have their own culture, defined as a behavioral tradition that a population maintains, not through genetic inheritance, but through social learning. That struck Shigay as a cause for celebration, not culling. Wasn't there a better way to relate to clever creatures? Or was cleverness precisely what made them pests? It's hard to live with animals that are intelligent, Shigay said. They can challenge you, and you have to adapt. The nearly 50 species of crow, which includes ravens and rooks, emerged long before human civilization. Unlike house sparrows and street pigeons, single species that humans helped to introduce to urban spaces, different crows adapted to different places. American crows to Seattle, house crows to Delhi, large-billed crows to Tokyo, carrion crows to Paris. All the things we do to make our lives comfortable feed into what they need for habitat and food and shelter, Marsloff told me. Vast flocks of crows can survive on what humans throw away. In 2008, Joshua Klein, a hacker who often wore tight black t-shirts, gave a TED talk about the intelligence of crows. Crows are notorious dumpster divers, but Klein was convinced that a crow vending machine could train them to collect trash and other items, like coins. Let's build something that's mutually beneficial, he said, and find some way to make a new relationship with these species. First, Klein planned to mix food and coins on the machine's platform. Once crows got used to feeding there, he would remove the food. When hungry crows knocked a coin down a chute, whether by accident or in frustration, a sensor would command the machine to release some food. Klein predicted that a few crows would learn the association between their undirected action and the reward and start bringing coins for their own accord. Others would then copy the behavior. Millions of people watched Klein's presentation, and in 2008, the New York Times Magazine reported that he had successfully built his machine. But the magazine effectively retracted the story after discovering that he had exaggerated his success. Klein said that the errors were the result of a misunderstanding. Crows were certainly intelligent enough to associate coin or trash collection with food rewards, but they had plenty of other places to eat. In the real world, they largely avoided Klein's noisy device. Although Klein failed, his idea caught on. Designers in the Netherlands and an entrepreneur in Sweden tried to build their own machines. A few hobbyists even managed to teach magpies to bring bottle caps to backyard machines. However, no one managed to disrupt the waste collection business with a flock of garbage birds. We didn't have a full working device that was tested with crows, Ruben van der Vleuten, the Dutch co-founder of a 2017 project to clean up cigarette butts called Crowded Cities, told me. At the same time, this thing was going viral. We were in so many media outlets. There was social learning going on, but not in crows. Rather, humans seemed to understand that in the attention economy, clicks and eyeballs were their own rewards. In 2020, another business school graduate, Jules Molleret, set out to build a new vending machine for crows, which would exchange trash for bird food. He founded a Marseille-based company, Birds for Change, that aimed to educate people about crows and plastic waste. And he asked Jaguet whether he could experiment in the Jardin des Plantes. "I thought it was a very good opportunity to change people's mind on the species," Jaguet told me. He gave Malheureux permission to install the machine in part of the garden where students grow grapes. I was intrigued by Malheureux's experiment because I often fed crows on my apartment balcony in Berlin. What started as a pandemic-era distraction became an obsession and a daily routine. I had always thought of animal intelligence as something remote and endangered. The most famous brainy beast, such as chimpanzees and orcas, lived in distant forests and open oceans, not cities. But in Berlin, a handful of peanuts was enough to bring animal intelligence to me. The same cognitive skills that help crows recognize threats enabled these birds to recognize me as a source of peanuts. And soon they started waking me up at 5 a.m. by knocking on my window with their beaks. When I called Malheureux, he told me that after almost 2 years of tinkering with the machine, the crows were nearing the end of their training. They were almost ready to collect bottle caps on their own, he said. And so, on a bright September morning, I arrived at the Jardin des Plantes. I knew the garden as the place where Ralph Waldo Emerson deepened his interest in natural history. After visiting in 1833, he wrote that the limits of the possible are enlarged here. I found a bench near Malheureux's machine. Crows can be beautiful birds whose black feathers shimmer green and violet like an aurora in the night sky. In late summer, however, Parisian crows looked ragged from their annual molt. Near my feet, a few nibbled at a discarded peach, but showed no interest in trash collecting. Through my binoculars, I could see that Malheureux was still sprinkling loose food along with the bottle caps on the platform. It seemed that he, too, had overpromised. The crows weren't even close to collecting trash on their own. I soon learned that he was managing the project remotely from Marseille, with only a part-time helper in Paris. The platform often sat empty over weekends, giving the crows no reason to think of the machine as a reliable source of food. "I don't think it's working," Jaguet confessed to me later. Malheureux seemed to think that because crows are smart, their behavior should be predictable and programmable, even if his own behavior wasn't. He was treating ecology like a subset of mechanics, as though the crows themselves could be turned into cogs in a machine. Klein, the inventor of the crow vending machine, has called himself a passionate hacker of all things. But the more I watched crows in the Jardin des Plantes, the more I wondered who was hacking whom. I saw crows fish McDonald's bags out of trash cans and follow strollers and toddlers, knowing that children were more likely to drop crumbs. They visited the garden's menagerie, one of the world's oldest zoos, to raid food from the llama and ray enclosures. Evolution had empowered crows to expose the weak spots in our designs, and I found myself admiring their mischief as a rebellion against our hubris. Crows and ravens have co-evolved with us since the time of Neanderthals, and yet we've never domesticated them, Marslove, the Seattle ecologist, told me. The real mark of crow genius may be its ability to maintain independence in spaces that humans think of as their own. A few years ago, Jaguet's children began playing Pokemon Go, the smartphone game in which users catch virtual animals as they wander through real-life spaces. He tried, unsuccessfully, to interest his kids in real animals. But in the end, he wound up downloading the game himself. He started to chase Pokemon through the Jardin des Plantes, which was one of the best places in Paris to catch them. Fittingly, many of the garden's manicured paths were named after famous 19th-century naturalists, some of whom collected actual animals as though they were Pokemon, filling the Natural History Museum's cabinets with curious creatures. One day in 2017, Jigay met a woman named Marilan Tepamart, who was also playing Pokemon Go in the Jardin des Plantes. Capturing virtual animals, which did not heckle or bite, was a welcome respite from trapping cranky crows. But there were several birds in Jigay's cage that day, and he invited Tepamart to help him attach rings to their legs. Tepamart was startled to go from chasing imaginary creatures on her own to suddenly holding a live crow in her hands. "Its heart was bumping because it was so stressed out," Tepamart told me. She felt as nervous as the bird. Tepamart started to recognize the garden's crows by the colors and numbers of their rings. "It was almost like Crow Go," she recalled. "I was interested in getting as many rings as it was possible for me to get." Diane Dabir-Mogadam, who studies beetles at the museum and watches crows in her free time, told me that because you can see the rings, you can begin to remember them, have a relationship with them, and know how they behave. Here was a third way to connect with crows, beyond culling or training them, simply getting to know them in the spaces we share. Even Jigay, who normally concerns himself with population trends, started to see crows as individuals with distinct personalities. "There are a few birds that have special histories," he told me. Jigay banded one such crow, Green 279, after he fell from a nest and grew up in an animal rescue center. He was the only rescued crow to survive after being released into the garden. Green 279, who was named for the color and number on his ring, willingly entered Jigay's cage to eat, having learned that he would always be released again. But he also seemed to hate Jigay. "This is the most aggressive bird to my fingers," he told me. Green 279 was able to distinguish friend from foe. When I sat with Tepamart and Dabir-Mogadam on a bench in the garden, he soon turned up. The women teasingly called him Globetrotter because he had never been seen outside the gardens. "He takes food from my fingers," Tepamart told me. "He has come onto my shoulder," Dabir-Mogadam added. Green 279 watched us closely. "He wants cat kibble," Tepamart explained. Dabir-Mogadam apologized to him for bringing only peanuts. Watching them, I thought about a pair of crows that I feed from my Berlin balcony. At first, to test their wits, I set up small puzzles, which struck me as the obvious way to interact with smart animals. But with time, I realized that the crows were solving a larger puzzle than any of my contraptions. The female figured out that if she fluffed up her feathers or just patiently stared me down, I would come to the balcony with a handful of peanuts. I grew to love her not because I could bend her behavior, but because she was capable of bending mine. Lauren Isley, the 20th century anthropologist, once wrote about a crow that nearly crashed into his head on a foggy day and subsequently cawed at him every day as he walked to the train station. He described what they shared as a viewpoint in common. Hundreds of millions of years of evolution separate humans from birds, but our worlds had interpenetrated, Isley wrote. That day in Paris, the Jardin des Plantes felt like a borderland where worlds were colliding. As I walked through the garden with Tepamart and Dabir-Mogadam, Green 279 and his companions followed us. Near a pond, we scattered some peanuts, but many of the crows lost interest. They had spotted a young girl who was eating brioche. Then we came upon two other women who were also tossing peanuts. "There's quite a community of people who are interested in the crows," Tepamart told me. Green 279 had now extracted so many peanuts from his human admirers that he didn't want to eat any more. Instead, he began caching peanuts under some fallen leaves so he could return to them later. We were the crow vending machine, I realized, and the birds had mastered the art of manipulating us for rewards. Spilled trash seemed like a small price to pay for proximity to such clever minds. Next, from the books section of the March 18, 2024 issue of the New Yorker magazine, how an enthusiast of Soviet socialism fell afoul of the authorities. Andrei Platonov's Shevengur depicts a communist utopia, but Stalin loathed his writing, calling the author scum, by Benjamin Kunkel. The Roman god Janus was possessed of two faces, one pointing toward the future and one looking backward into the past. And it's tempting to imagine that these faces must also have worn contrasting expressions, one brighter and hopeful, the other rueful or even aghast. Supposing you knew such a person, how would you go about introducing him? Which of the two faces, enthusiastic or downcast, should be presented first? The problem poses itself immediately when it comes to Shevengur, Andrei Platonov's strange tale of a communist peasant utopia. Written in 1927 and 1928, when Platonov was in his late 20s, it both represents his high-spirited debut as a socialist novelist and reads like a dissident's political suicide note. And, in the split perspective afforded by the book's contradictory point of view, it's possible to see both the initial construction and the ultimate collapse of the Soviet project as overlapping features of the same landscape. In, quote, the deserted shelterlessness of the steppe, end quote. The novel's very few first readers were understandably perplexed. On the one hand, there was an honest attempt to portray the beginning of a communist society, as Platonov described his efforts in a letter to his powerful colleague, Maxim Gorky, in 1929, in a bid to secure official approval for the book's publication. Platonov seems to have sincerely thought that his novel depicted the advent of Soviet socialism in a favorable enough light. What authority could take offense at his depiction of a group of peasant citizens invoking collectivization as their salvation from the hunger and toil that constitute the only life they or their forebears had known? On the other hand, here was a work in which the regime's newfangled jargon, communism, the proletariat, however gamely deployed by the unlettered tenants of the open steppe, betrays a welter of confusion, privation, and violence that rivals anything in the bad old pre-Bolshevik days. "Whatever you may have wished," Gorky replied to Platonov, "you have portrayed reality in a lyrico-satirical light that is, of course, unacceptable to our censorship." Gorky was right. Platonov's novel was set up in type, but at the last minute, the publisher scuttled the project. Gorky's neologism, lyrico-satirical, is a fair characterization of Platonov's style in Shevengur and elsewhere, but it also comes across like one of those references to apparent impossibilities which one encounters in reading about quantum physics. How can light be both particle and wave? In literature, anyway, the lyrical suggests a wave of praise and celebration, whereas the satirical indicates particles of jeering condemnation. The authorities, unable to get a fix on Platonov's attitude, declined to publish Shevengur during his lifetime. In fact, this black herald of the dawn of the Soviet experiment didn't appear in Russia until 1988, in the fading dusk of the USSR. Now, in the third decade of the 21st century, a new English language translation of the novel by Robert and Elizabeth Chandler, published by NYRB Classics, gives us another chance to trap the mercury of a prose style that seems intended both lyrically to stir one's heart and satirically to freeze one's blood in the same escaping moment of history. Like lyrico-satirical, the term history is a word that can paper over unsolvable ambiguities. Platonov's career was a victim of his times, but had he lived a generation earlier, he would probably never have become a writer. born in 1899 in Voronezh, 300 miles south of Moscow. He was the son of a watchmaker's daughter and a metal worker employed on the railways. The eldest of 11 children, he was put to work at the age of 13 and became an insatiable autodidact, reading deeply in philosophy. For working-class young men like Platonov, the Bolshevik Revolution opened up huge vistas of opportunity, not merely for self-betterment, but for the creation of a new society. By the time he turned 20, he was studying engineering and publishing articles and idealistic poems in the local press, at one point as a journalist embedded with the Red Army. When drought brought famine to the region in 1921, he decided that his engineering skills were needed more than his literary ones and set writing aside to work on the digging of wells and on land reclamation projects. It was not until 1927 that he began publishing again, drawing his preoccupations and even his style from his close contact with the Russian hinterland. Old provincial towns have tumble-down outskirts and people come straight from nature to live there, Platonov writes at the start of Chevengur. Already apparent is the studied and graceful clumsiness for which his prose is renowned. How can 20th century subjects of the Tsar, historical rather than natural beings, come straight from nature to live anywhere? Evoking the naivete of what Marx called rural idiocy, the phrase summons up a condition of ignorance and illiteracy so deep and unchanging as to encourage hard-scrabble people to accept their pinched conditions as natural. In much the same way that a non-human animal might take for granted the horns on its head or the spots of its coat. The next sentence reads, "A man appears with a keen-eyed face that has been worn to an extreme of sadness, a man who can fix up or equip anything, but who has himself lived through life unequipped." The man is one Zakhar Pavlovich, the focus of the first, more or less pre-revolutionary section of Chevengur. Based in part on Platonov's father, he is a barely literate handyman who, in his love of neat and dry machinery, as opposed to the moist and messy operations of mere nature, has unwittingly been dreaming of socialism throughout his five decades of life, and is therefore delighted to get a job stoking train engines. Quote, "Zakhar Pavlovich respected coal, wrought iron, sleeping raw materials, and half-manufactured items of all kinds. But he truly loved and sensed only the finished artifacts into which man had been transformed through labor and that would live on further with a life of their own." End quote. In Chevengur, the great revolutionary events of the late teens and early 1920s, the various ephemeral triumphs of history over nature, typically take place in the misty background of the cascading story. For us, as for the book's characters, it's often difficult to tell when exactly things shift from the end of Tsarism to the eruption of the Russian Civil War to the advent of war communism under Lenin. At any rate, Zakhar soon takes under his wing, as a fellow railway worker, our true protagonist, Sasha Dvanov, a young man who, with the heroic simplicity characteristic of Platonov's people, seems to have taken literally Marx's dictum that revolutions are, quote, the locomotives of history, end quote. As post-revolutionary factions multiply, Sasha, an orphan of the Hungry Land, decides that he should assign himself to one political movement or another. He and Zakhar set about, quote, looking for the most serious party in order to join it at once, ideally one that had no incomprehensible program and where everything they said was clear and true, end quote. It's possible to glimpse a good deal of Platonov's singular tone and method in a scene in which Sasha and Zakhar, frustrated that no faction will disclose, quote, precisely how and when earthly bliss would dawn, end quote, hastily barter off their political allegiances with the representatives of various parties. It reads, "Some replied that happiness was a complex artifact, and that man's aim lay not in happiness, but in the zealous fulfillment of historical laws. And others said that happiness was a matter of out-and-out struggle, which would last eternally. From the next party, they heard that man was such a magnificent and greedy being that it was strange even to think about sating him with happiness. That would be the end of the world." "Just what we need," said Zakhar Pavlovich. Behind the end door in the corridor was the very last party, with the very longest name. There was only one gloomy man sitting there. The others had gone off to exercise their power.
"What do you want?"
"We both want to join. Will it be the end of everything soon?"
"Socialism, you mean?"
The man misunderstood.
"A year from now. Today we're merely occupying institutions."
"Then put our names down," said Zakhar Pavlovich joyfully. The party with the very longest name is none other than the Russian Social Democratic Party of Bolsheviks, or Lenin's Communist Party. Sizing up its lone provincial representative, Zakhar thinks, quote, "Probably he stood for the very cleverest of powers. Within a year, this power would either construct the whole world once and for all, or else kick up a futility to exhaust even the heart of a child," end quote. Like dozens of other passages in the austere but overspilling world of Shevengur, this one displays the way that Platonov's fiction pulls in different directions at once. The earnestness with which the characters take revolutionary slogans at face value can quickly send their aspirations for earthly bliss sliding toward sarcasm, even as the general collapse or raising of language accompanies the raising of a new social structure. And, all the while, quote, "the heart of a child," end quote, is perpetually preserved in the lyricism of the prose as a sort of incorruptible judge of the antic, grim, and unrelenting proceedings of the story. Before long, Sasha, in his forlorn wanderlust, has split up with Zakhar and fallen in with a fellow Bolshevik named Stepan Kopionkin. Addressing each other as comrade, they set out across the post-revolutionary landscape, surveying peasant life and ultimately reaching, by separate routes, a place named Shevengur, whose inhabitants are rumored to have swapped stark famine for the teeming abundance of communism. Sasha liked the word Shevengur. It sounded like the enticing hum of an unknown country. Sasha and Stepan embark on their quest with the civil war, quote, "evident all around them, in shards and splinters of the nation's possessions, dead horses, carts, brigands' coats, and pillows," end quote. If the first part of the novel might be described as Bildungsroman, the second is kind of bloody picaresque, shot through with allusions to Don Quixote, though the Cervantine comedy is registered less in laughter than in grimaces. Stepan, a Quixote to Sasha's Sancho Panza, rides a dreary cart horse named, whether lyrically or satirically on Platonov's part, Strength of the Proletariat. And the tumbling incidents that ensue are hardly less absurd in Platonov's narration than they are in the bare enumeration of them. A near-fatal run-in with anarchist raiders, a parley with a man who keeps a cockroach as a pet, an overnight stay with a peasant named Pashinstev, who has single-handedly defended the revolution, so he says, against white or czarist soldiers using homemade armor and dud grenades. Marx famously said that all world historical events happen twice. First, as tragedy, and then as farce. But if you are short on time, you can combine the two and stage a farce every bit as violent as the fifth act of a Jacobean tragedy. Platonov writes, quote, "Kopionkin saw brigands and members of the White Guard as enemies of minor importance, unworthy of his personal fury,
and he killed with the same scrupulous everyday diligence with which a peasant woman weeds her millet. He fought accurately, but without wasting time, without stopping or dismounting, unconsciously preserving his own feelings for further hope and movement. End quote. The bumptious and harrowing music of the novel's first two sections is already enough to make Scheveningen one of the more amazing works of 20th century fiction. In the third and final part, however, the work becomes less an ordinary novel, of whatever extraordinary kind, than a different genre of writing entirely. It evolves into a kind of utopia, not in the usual sense of a work depicting a world better than our own, but in the Marxist critic Frederick Jameson's sense of portraying a society undeniably and radically other than the one we know. Once Sasha and Stepan have at last crossed the corpse-littered emptiness of southern Russia and reached Scheveningen, they confront a society that simultaneously flouts and confirms the basic precepts of Marxism, one of hunger and leisure, where work is disowned in the name of the laboring masses. Nobody in Scheveningen, whose residents proclaim that they are establishing communism, appears to have so much as consulted the Communist Manifesto. "Does everyone have to read Karl Marx?" asked Stepan of a Scheveningenian by the name of Chaperny. "Not at all," Chaperny answers. "I haven't read him either, not in all my born days. I just picked up a little at rallies and demonstrations, enough for agitation and propaganda. And there's really no need to read anything at all. In the old days, people read and wrote, but they didn't do any goddamn living." Despite all this, life in Scheveningen makes the reality of the proletariat, of the dispossessed as a collective entity with the power to make their passive abjection into the active subject of historical change, as palpable a phenomenon as it has ever been in modern literature. Here, Sasha, melding in his own way with the masses, trades his status as the novel's main character for the point of view of Chaperny. In the past, Chaperny, too, had wandered about with other people in search of temporary work, and had slept in sheds and barns, surrounded by comrades and insured by their fellow feeling against inescapable troubles. But he had failed to grasp that such a mutually inseparable life was to his own benefit. Now he saw with his own eyes the steppe and the sun, and people located on this mound between the earth and the sun, but who possessed neither of them. And he sensed for the first time how, in place of the steppe, the homes, the food, and the clothes that the bourgeoisie had acquired for themselves, the proletarians on the mound possessed one another, since everyone needs to possess something. When property lies between people, they calmly expend their powers on concerns about that property. But when there is nothing between people, then they choose not to part from one another and to preserve one another from cold in their sleep. In the end, the collective experiment that is Scheveningen finds itself fending off an attack from outside soldiers. With perfect Platonovian ambiguity, it is impossible to say whether the assailants are whites, czarists, or reds, Soviets. In other words, whether communism, at least of Platonov's ramshackle anarchic kind, finally falls victim to the past or to the future. Platonov was still a young man, by the calendar anyway, when he completed Scheveningen and saw its hopes for publication dashed. He fared no better with The Foundation Pit, a short novel completed in 1930, which didn't appear in the Soviet Union until the Glasnost days of 1987. This time, the reaction of the authorities couldn't have come as too much of a surprise, given that The Foundation Pit reads like a parody of such socialist realist works as Fyodor Gladkov's Cement, published in 1925, whose hero overcomes personal despair to contribute to the reorganization of a local cement factory. The foundation pit concerns the collective excavation of a site for an enormous apartment building meant to house the local proletariat, but unlikely, as the story ends, to ever be constructed. A hole of futility and death, like a common grave. The year after Platonov finished the foundation pit, Stalin wrote Fool, Idiot, and Scum in the margins of one of the author's stories, and then contacted the publishers of the journal it appeared in, calling him, quote, an agent of our enemies, end quote. In 1934, the Soviet Literary Encyclopedia complained that Platonov showed the Soviet state apparatus not as a form of the participation of workers and peasants in governing the country, but as a mechanical apparatus of coercion, of the leveling down of the individual. In 1938, Platonov's 15-year-old son was arrested on charges of subversive activity, almost certainly confected in order to keep Platonov in line. The boy spent 3 years in the gulag. Though a powerful literary friend eventually secured his release, he had by then contracted a fatal case of tuberculosis. Platonov's ideological errors were never quite enough to rule out a literary career altogether, and he remained a paid-up member of the Soviet Writers' Union for the rest of his life. During the Second World War, he served as a correspondent for the newspaper Red Star and was able to publish excerpts of a final, longish work of fiction, the novella Zan, or Soul, in which an impeccably socialist realist plotline to do with shepherding a Central Asian people out of immemorial poverty and into communism doesn't seem to preclude a deep personal horror at widespread hunger. The very same horror animates the early chapters of Chavingur, something that makes the arguably anti-Soviet novel also an undeniably socialist production. Platonov died in 1951 from tuberculosis, which he most likely caught as he nursed his dying son. In the nearly 75 years since, he has enjoyed several posthumous careers, first during the 1970s, he was a dissident writer, his major works finally published in the West, but available inside the Soviet Union only in Zamzadat form, while exiled Russian sessionist Joseph Brodsky lionized him as one of the half-dozen greatest novelists of the 20th century. By the time the USSR fell in 1991, it was no longer the cackling mockery of agitprop language, but the element of possibility and sincere hope that had become more striking in Platonov, at least to left-wing Western intellectuals. For Frederick Jameson, in his 1994 book, The Seeds of Time, the catastrophic peasant utopia of Chavingur represented no kind of ideal society, but it did indicate the deep and discreetly enduring potential for a different way of relating to time, death, and the vast demographic reality of other people, the notorious masses, than was on offer during the thoroughly commercial and individualistic end of history of the 90s. In our time, 3 decades later, the return of mass hunger to the world scene, with tens of millions on the brink of starvation thanks to war, inflation, and climate change, means that a famine-stalked utopian or dystopian revolutionary novel such as Chavingur no longer reads merely as an ambiguous testament to a vanished Soviet past. The revival of such an old and essential problem is bound to reawaken bygone political programs too, no matter what names they go under. Stepan asks Sasha, what's the word for those thoughts that flow first this way and then that way? Dilemmas? Dialectics, Sasha imperturbably replies. Next, a very short story from the flash fiction section of the September 7th, 2023 issue of the New Yorker, My Cheesecake-Shaped Poverty, by Haruki Murakami. The Triangle Zone was our name for the place. I couldn't think of any better name for it. I mean, the area was a perfect triangle, as if someone had drawn it out. And she and I lived there on that land. This was back in 1973 or 1974. When I say triangle zone, don't go picturing a kind of delta. The triangle zone we lived in was much narrower, more like a wedge. Imagine, say, a round, full-sized cheesecake. Cut it into 12 equal pieces with a knife, so it's like the face of a clock. What you'd end up with, of course, are 12 slices of 30 degrees each at the tip. Place one of these on a plate, and as you sip your tea, take a good hard look at it. That tapered end of the thin slice of cake, that's exactly the shape of the triangle zone I'm talking about. Okay, so how did such a weirdly shaped plot of land come about? Well, you might ask, or maybe not. Either way's fine with me, since I don't know the answer. I asked some of the neighbors about it, but all I found out was that it was been shaped like a triangle long, long ago, was a triangle now, and would probably, far, far into the future, remain a triangle. People there didn't seem to want to talk about this triangle zone or even think about it. For them, it was like talking about a wart behind your ear, better left undiscussed, probably because of its weird shape. Railroad lines ran along either side of the triangle zone, one a national railway line, the other a private line. The two lines ran parallel for a while. Then, at the very tip of the wedge, formed a junction, where it was as if they were ripped apart, branching off at strange angles, one north and one south. It was quite a sight to see. Whenever I gazed at the trains whizzing by at the tip of the triangle zone, I felt as if I were standing on the bridge of a destroyer slicing its way through ocean waves. In terms of livability, the triangle zone was appalling. First of all, there was the obvious noise level. But what do you expect? How could it not be ear-splitting to live hemmed in between two railroad lines? Open the front door and there was a train roaring by. Open a window at the back of the house and yet another train would thunder by, right before your eyes. And when I say right before your eyes, I'm not exaggerating. The trains were so close that I could look the passengers in the eye and nod a greeting. Really something, now that I think about it. You'd assume that it would be quiet after the last train of the night had passed by, right? Well, I thought so too, before I moved there. Problem was, there was no such thing as a last train. The last passenger train was just before 1 a.m., but then came the late-night freight trains, and once they'd finished rolling by at dawn, the next day's passenger trains would start up again. It was an endless repeat of this, day after day. Talk about crazy. We picked this place to live in for one simple reason. It was dirt cheap. It was a detached house with three rooms, its own bath, and even a small garden, all for about the same price as renting a studio apartment. Since it was a standalone house, we could bring our cat along too. It was as if the place had been specially made just for us. We'd only recently got married, and not to brag or anything, but we could very well have been featured in the Guinness Book of World Records under World's Poorest Couple. We saw the house listed in the window of a real estate agent's office near the station. At least as far as the rent and the layout of the rooms were concerned, this was a lucky find. Astonishing, even. "Yeah, yeah, cheap it is, for sure," the bald real estate agent said. "But I have to warn you, it's really noisy. As long as you can stand that, you could call it a lucky find." "Would you mind showing it to us?" I asked. "Sure, but can't the two of you just go? I get a headache every time I go to that place." He handed me the keys, drew a map. What an easygoing agent. On the map, the triangle zone didn't look far from the station, but when we actually walked to it, it took forever. we had to detour around the railroad tracks, cross an overpass, and trudge up and down a somewhat filthy hill before we finally arrived at the rear of the Triangle Zone. There wasn't a store in sight. A totally seedy neighborhood. My wife and I went to the house at the very tip of the Triangle Zone and stayed for about an hour, just hanging out. During this time, trains kept on rumbling past. Whenever an express train roared by, the windows would rattle. We couldn't hear each other while a train was passing. We'd be talking and then would have to stop until it was gone. We'd resume talking when it got quiet, only to be interrupted a moment later by yet another train. Choppy, interrupted communication a la Jean-Luc Godard. Aside from the noise, the house wasn't so bad. The structure itself was old-fashioned and in need of some serious repair. But on the plus side, it had a Tokonoma recessed alcove and a small outside sitting area attached to the house, and had a nice feel to it. Spring light shining in through the windows formed little sunny squares on the tatami. It was a lot like the house I'd lived in years ago when I was little. "Let's take it," I said. "I know it's noisy, but we'll get used to it." "If that's what you think, I'm okay with it," she said. "Sitting here together like this, it feels like we're married, our own family." "Well, we are married."
"Well, yeah, true enough," I said. We went back to the real estate agency and told the bald agent that we'll take it.
"Isn't it too noisy?" he asked.
"Yes, it is, but we'll get used to it," I said. The agent took off his glasses, wiped them with a tissue, and took a sip of tea from his teacup, put his glasses back on, and looked at me.
"Well, 'cause you're young," he said.
"Right," I replied, and we filled out the rental agreement. A friend's little minivan was more than enough for our move. Futons, clothes, a lamp, a few books, and a cat. That was the extent of our belongings. Nothing else. No radio or TV, no washer or dining table, or gas stove or telephone or kettle or vacuum cleaner. That was how poor we were. So our move, such as it was, took only half an hour. Life can be simpler if you don't have much money. When the friend who helped us move took one look at our new dwelling, hemmed in by railroad lines, he was aghast. After we'd unloaded everything, he turned to me and said something, but a passing express train drowned out his words.
"Did you say something?" I asked.
"People really live in a place like this, huh?" he commented, impressed. We ended up living in that house for 2 years. It was a poorly built house in a way, since wind blew in through cracks and gaps all over the place. Pleasant enough in the summer, but come winter it was hell. With no money to buy a space heater, my wife and I and the cat would crawl under the futons once the sun set, literally clinging to each other to keep warm. Many a time, we'd wake up to find the water in the kitchen faucet frozen solid. Once winter passed, the spring would come, and spring was a lovely season. She and I and the cat would breathe a sigh of relief. In April, the railroads went on strike for a few days, and we were ecstatic. Not a single train came rumbling by all day. We carried the cat down to the railroad tracks and sat there sunning ourselves. It was so quiet. It was as if we were sitting at the bottom of a lake. We were young, just married, and the sunshine was free. Even now, when I hear the word poor, I remember that thin, triangular sliver of land, and I wonder who could be living there now. I'll end today's broadcast with some poetry. The first poem is from the March 18, 2024 issue of The New Yorker, Men's Sexual Trauma Support Group, by Jose Antonio Rodriguez. It's less about talking and more about the physical response, the facilitator said. We sat in a circle on fold-out chairs and looked at the shuffling feet. Imagined trusting someone else with one's body. What would that be like?
The question I may have read in their glances. Hard to say, busy as I was recalling, hugging a friend after the long absence, or lifting the weighted bar off my chest at the gym, while my spotter traced its rise. So that was part of the good feeling, his body telling mine, I will not hurt you, nor let you be hurt, here, now. Hypervigilance, said the facilitator, comes after the freeze response. No longer necessary and yet persistent. I think I've gone through life observing it rather than living it, I said almost at hour's end. Wow, someone responded. I never had the words. And I didn't have the nerve to say that I'd made it my mission to find all the words, to fill every room with them. Let them fall over us, the faithful and the faithless, like balloons, like confetti, like glitter, landing with the gentlest touch. Well, we have time for a cartoon or two. In the first cartoon from the March 18, 2024 issue of The New Yorker, we see a TV weatherman standing in front of the map of the weather for the United States. And he says, according to our latest polls, voters trust me 7% more than either of the leading candidates. In the next cartoon, we see a man and his son looking out a window overlooking the skyline of New York City. The man has his hand on his son's shoulders, and he says to his son, one day, son, all these skyscrapers that we built for no reason and lie empty will be yours. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Well, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.